shelf next to the bed. He looked down at the cover. The Prisoner of Azkaban.
Hello?
Decker turned to see Joey staring up at him. Hello, Joey.
You're the Cleveland Brown.
That's right. Amos Decker.
What are you doing here?
Decker looked over his shoulder and said, I brought my friend Alex to meet you, Joey. He eyed Jameson, who still stood in the doorway, and inclined his head toward Joey. She slowly came into the room and drew close to the bed.
Hi, Joey. Hi, Alex.
He glanced at Decker's hand.
Did you come to read to me? Is it morning yet?
No, it's nighttime. We didn't mean to wake you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I wake up sometimes just because.
Decker and Jameson together watched the slender chest rise and fall, as Joey seemed to work to catch his breath.
Do you need us to get help?
Asked Jameson nervously. Joey shook his head.
No, it happens sometimes. It'll pass.
They waited another minute or so, and Joey's breathing became normal. Decker sat down in the chair next to the bed and held up the book. Anne was reading this to you?
Yeah.
A spear of lightning lit the sky. It was followed by a boom of thunder that made Jameson jump. Did she read the first two in the series to you? Decker asked.
The first two?
Yeah, this one is the third one. There are two books before it and four that come after it. You learn where Harry Potter came from and how he got to go to Hogwarts and meet his friends. Stuff like that. Joey looked confused.
No, that was the only one she'd been reading to me.
And she leaves it here?
Well, sometimes, but other times she takes it with her. But then she always brings it back. We don't have too many pages left. I think I can make it to the end.
He sucked in a huge breath.
I hope I can anyway.
At this, Jameson looked away, her eyes filling with tears. Decker looked very tense as he prepared to speak. Does anyone else come here and read this book to you, Joey? Jameson shot him a glance.
No, just Anne. Nobody else.
Decker said, You're sure?
Yeah, just Anne. I think it's her book. Why?
We were just wondering, Joey,
said Jameson hastily when it didn't appear that Decker was going to answer.
Do you like the story? The Harry Potter series is great. I started reading them when I was in elementary school.
Yeah, it's good. I like Harry, but Hermione is my favorite.
Why is that?
She likes to read. I do, too. I did, anyway. Lots of books.
He pointed at Decker.
But I played football, too, like him, before I got sick. I bet I would have been pretty good.
I bet you would have been pretty great,
said Jameson, trying very hard to keep her voice from cracking. Decker looked down at the book, as though it had somehow failed him. Well, thanks, Joey, he said. Maybe I'll come back and finish reading this book to you.
And maybe I can come too,
said Jameson suddenly, seeming to surprise even herself with the comment.
That would be good,
said Joey.
Thanks. Maybe you can meet Anne.
Yeah, maybe, said Decker.
I used to do a lot of volunteer work,
said Jameson.
Maybe I can volunteer here. How about that, Joey?
Sure,
he said, but then his smile faded and all his energy seemed to disappear along with it. He closed his eyes and his breathing deepened a bit.
This is beyond sad,
whispered Jameson.
He's just a little boy. Doesn't he have anybody?
No. He was going to be adopted, but the people apparently pulled out when he got sick.
What bastards.
And the world is full of them, Alex.
What were you hoping to prove with that book?
Just trying to make sense out of something. I was pretty sure, but that goes to show that anybody can be wrong. Decker rose and was about to put the book back when Joey opened his eyes and turned his head to look at him.
It's funny, though,
said Joey. What is? Asked Decker quickly.
I woke up tonight and saw you with the book.
Decker glanced down at the book and then back up at Joey. Yeah? What's funny about that?
Well, I've woken up a couple times, I guess, during the night, and I saw him with the book, too. That was what's funny. I mean, it's not like he reads to me. And then he walked out with it. But when I woke up the next morning, it was back on the shelf. Both times.
Who? Asked Decker, his voice unusually tight. Who took the book?
The guy with the glasses. I think his name is...
He stopped to think for a moment.
You know, like the chipmunk? You mean...
began Jameson. Decker had already turned and rushed out of the room.
Alvin.
Finished Jameson, before turning and running after Decker. Chapter 55. An irritated Decker hovered at the front entrance to Dominion Hospice. Bogart was talking to a police officer in the front parking lot. The man hurried off and Bogart turned and headed over to Decker. The reality was not a good one. Alvin Jenkins was nowhere to be found. He hadn't gone to make rounds. He had apparently fled the premises right after leaving Decker and Jameson in his office. Decker had called Bogart in immediately. The last several hours had been spent searching the building and finding nothing helpful. Bogart said, "We have a bolo out on him, and we have a team in his apartment, or at least at the address that was in his file. I bet the guy had an exit plan that he activated as soon as we came here asking questions. He's probably got a half dozen passports that would pass any scrutiny. Hell, he might be on a private jet, heading back to wherever he came from." Decker groaned and looked miserable. "I was too slow, Ross. I missed the window." "I don't fully understand how you even came to suspect this place had anything to do with anything." "Berkshire would never have wasted time coming here unless it served her purpose." He held up the book. "Your lab guys need to check this book out. There's something in here that was important to both Berkshire and Jenkins. I'm surprised he didn't try to take it before now." "Will do." Bogart took the book and sealed it in a plastic evidence bag he pulled from his overcoat. "Harry Potter, what do you think is in here?" "Maybe a coded message using the words in there somehow."
"So Alvin Jenkins was working with Ann Berkshire. Do you think he was the one who attacked you and stole the flash drive?"
Decker shrugged. "I don't know. I know appearances can be deceiving, but he doesn't look the type to wield a long-range sniper rifle. And he's pretty small and in his 50s. Whoever walloped me, I just think he was a lot younger and a lot bigger. It takes a lot to knock me out."
"So someone else is out there?"
"Well, if it is a spy ring, they could have a lot of members. Or they could have called in reinforcements from whatever country they're spying for. And since we know Berkshire once worked for the Soviets, that list of possible suspects is pretty short."
"We'll dig into Jenkins' background. He had to undergo some background checks to get a job here, you would think."
Decker just looked out into the darkness, lost in thought.
"Something else bugging you?" asked Bogart.
"The woman was reading a book to a dying kid just as a way to send stolen secrets," said Decker.
Bogart shook his head. "Yeah, I was thinking about that too." He added, "I always thought I wanted kids. Didn't work out that way, and I'll soon be a divorced man. But I still think about it."
Decker gazed over at him. "You can still marry again. Have kids, Ross."
"I think raising kids is a younger man's game. I'm not far off the big 5-0.
Decker shrugged. "Just saying it's a possibility, but then what do I know? I had a kid. Now I don't."
"You were still a father, Amos. You had a daughter. You would still have a daughter if the world weren't so screwed up."
"Well, I don't, and it is. So why wish for something you can't ever have?"
Bogart looked uncomfortable. "Where's Alex?"
"I think she's still sitting with Joey Scott. With all the police activity, I think the patients here got woken up and rattled. She's calming him down."
"So the boy really has nobody?"
"Apparently not. I don't know how much longer he has to live." "I guess not long. Sometimes it's enough to make you want to put a gun against your head and pull the trigger." He looked at Bogart. "Just like Walter Dabney did."
"He had choices, Amos. Everybody has choices."
"Yeah, it's just that sometimes all those choices suck." Bogart said,
"I'm going to get this book down to the lab."
Decker curtly nodded, and Bogart hurried out into the rain and then into his sedan. Decker watched him drive off. He turned and walked back down the corridor until he reached Joey Scott's room. Jameson was sitting on the edge of the bed. She looked up when Decker appeared in the doorway.
"He just fell asleep,"
she whispered, rising off the bed and joining Decker in the doorway. "Bogart is taking the book to the lab to check it out."
"No sign of Jenkins?"
He shook his head. Jameson glanced over at the bed where Joey lay sleeping.
Can you imagine anything more heartless than what those people did? Using the cover of a dying little boy to pass along stolen secrets?
I've yet to see the limits of people being heartless, replied Decker. But yeah, it's pretty damn heartless.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but maybe Dabney did a good thing by shooting her.
There would be plenty of people to agree with you, but it still doesn't make it right.
I know, I'm just venting. What's our next step?
She asked. Maybe they can still catch Jenkins. Then he might talk. Or they might find something at his apartment. But if it's anything like where Ann Berkshire lives, it'll turn up zip. Now, they could find something in the book. That might at least tell us something.
What about Natalie?
She's cutting her deal, and maybe they can get some more info out of her.
No, I mean, does her family know what she did?
Decker looked taken aback. I don't think so. Bogart didn't mention talking to them. The Bureau keeps a tight lid on stuff like that.
I feel sorry for that family. Lost a husband and father. Now a sister might be going to jail, too.
Like Bogart told me earlier, people have choices.
Do you think Natalie might have told her sisters anything? I mean, about what she might have done.
I don't know. I'm not sure how close she was to them. She lived out of the country, after all. She probably didn't see them all that much.
I wonder why she moved to France in the first place.
People do move to other countries.
I know, but the family seems so close-knit, and the other sisters stayed in the United States.
So Natalie was an outlier.
I guess.
Decker glanced sharply at her. Thank you.
For what?
For reminding me that I need to stop assuming shit that hasn't been proven. He walked off down the hall. Jameson started to go, then looked back at Joey. She hurried over to the bed, leaned down, and gave the sleeping boy a light kiss on his forehead. Then she hurried after Decker. Chapter 56. They drove back to the apartment and grabbed some sleep. They woke early, showered, changed clothes, and met in the kitchen. Decker had gotten there first and made coffee for both of them. The rain continued to pour down outside. Decker sipped his coffee while standing over by the window and looking out.
Have you heard from Brown?
Asked Jameson. Decker shook his head. No, why?
Just wondering.
He turned to look at her. Why, Alex? I know she's not your favorite person.
She and I had words last night. Okay, I spoke most of the words.
What did you say?
I was brutally candid.
About what?
About everything.
Decker snorted. Then I'm surprised she didn't shoot you.
I had a gun, too.
Decker walked back over to her. She's not a bad person, Alex.
But she's not a particularly good one, either. And she missed the stuff on Natalie. That was big.
And you thought back in Burlington that I had murdered my own family. Jameson's features turned dark.
I never thought that.
You suspected it.
I was a journalist back then. I had to cover all the angles.
So you've never made a mistake?
Of course I have. We all have.
I've made my share, particularly on this case, and I don't see you jumping on my butt.
Well, you own up to them, and you've done a lot of great stuff too, but I haven't seen her do much.
Okay, so long as you're keeping score, Brown saved my ass in the parking lot out there. But for her, you'd be living alone. And she opened up a lot more about her work than she probably wanted to. When I went to DIA that day, it was clear that her colleagues were pissed at what she'd done. And I got the impression that it might even cost her career-wise. But she did it because she wants to find out the truth. So she went to bed with Melvin. So what? The woman probably works 100-hour weeks and doesn't know what country she's going to be in week to week. She has all this money, but she apparently doesn't have anyone in her life. Her parents are dead. She has no siblings. She's probably pretty lonely, just like Melvin. So they found each other, at least for one night. Good for them.
Those are all fair points, but I don't see why you feel the need to keep defending her.
Because men seem to get an easy pass on a lot of things from the ladies. I don't know why, but they just do. It's like women hold other women to a higher standard in some ways.
Maybe we do,
said Jameson.
But women know how other women can be.
Cagey? They're doing calculus while men are still adding and subtracting? Jameson smiled grimly.
I was going to use another term, but I'm fine with cagey.
The fact is, we need Brown if we're going to get to the bottom of this thing. You don't have to like her, Alex. You just have to be able to work with her.
After our last meeting, I think that's going to be hard. Maybe more for her than me. I mean, I really laid it on, Decker.
She might have thicker skin than you think.
I guess we'll find out.
Decker's phone buzzed. He looked at the screen. Maybe sooner rather than later. She just texted me. Wants to meet. Jameson put down her coffee cup.
Where?
In answer, he pointed out the window. She's waiting in the parking lot. Decker and Jameson approached the big Beamer a minute later.
Nice wheels,
observed Jameson as they drew closer. Very nice, said Decker. He glanced at Jameson's ratty subcompact parked a few spaces away. And easier on my knees than your ride.
If you want me to maintain the peace, play nice,
Jameson said between clenched teeth.
You take shotgun.
They climbed in and buckled up. Brown said,
sorry to drag you out on such short notice.
Did you hear about last night?
Yes, nice catch. We've put out a global alert on this Alvin Jenkins, but if he made such a blatant run for it after you spooked him, he probably had a prearranged exit plan.
That's what I told Bogart.
What do you think might be in the book?
Asked Jameson from the back seat.
It's a bit old-fashioned, but codes and books are actually coming back into style for one good reason. Printed books can't be hacked. That alone justifies the return to ink and paper. I'm sure the FBI will check it for all the usual techniques.
She put the car in drive and they sped off. So where are we going? Asked Decker. Brown glanced at him before answering.
We have another murder. What?
Exclaimed Jameson. Who? Asked Decker sharply.
It's connected to the Dabneys. Ellie? One of the daughters?
Said a stunned Jameson.
No, it was the housekeeper, Cecilia Randall.
Chapter 57. They were not at the luxurious home of the Dabneys in Tony McLean. They were in southeast D.C., where eight of the rundown row houses would still not have equaled the square footage of the Dabneys' mansion. The police were there, and the house in question was strung off with yellow tape, stretching and pitching in the wind. How'd you find out so fast? Asked Decker, as he, Brown, and Jameson stared over at the front entrance. Gawkers were out and looking around curiously at all the police activity. Brown said,
I've got a contact at the Metro Police. She knew about my interest in the Dabneys. When the call came in and they found out where she worked, my contact called me. I phoned Bogart. He should be here shortly.
A gurney was wheeled out of the front of the house with a body in a black body bag.
What do they know so far?
Asked Jameson.
How was she killed? Metro is keeping a tight lid on this, and they will until the Bureau shows up. DIA doesn't carry as much weight with the locals as the FBI.
Well, here they come, noted Decker, as Bogart's car pulled up, and he and Milligan jumped out and hustled over to them. Brown explained things in a few sentences, and Bogart and Milligan headed over to the officer in charge. They watched as the FBI agents flashed their badges and made their pitch. The body language of the officer changed immediately. He pulled a notebook from his pocket and he started talking. 5 minutes later, Bogart and Milligan returned to them. Okay, small caliber gunshot to the back of the head, said Bogart. Looks like a professional hit. She's been dead about 6 hours, which puts her death at about 2 in the morning. So far, they've found no one who saw or heard anything. Forced entry? Asked Decker. They're still checking. Nothing so far indicates that, but it's not been confirmed.
Would she have let the person in?
Asked Brown. If her death occurred shortly after the person came, who would she let into her house at 2 a.m.? Someone she knew really well, said Decker. This may not even be connected to our case, said Milligan, looking around. This is not exactly a safe area. If it was a break and enter, they would have taken things, said Decker. Anything missing? Nothing obvious, but they're still looking. She might have had enemies, or the person might have gone to the wrong house. Or she was killed because she knew something about our case, said Decker.
But what could she know?
Asked Jameson. Brown said,
she worked at the Dabneys, saw them every day. She might have overheard something, seen something.
But why kill her now? Asked Decker. We've been investigating this case for a while now, and nothing happened to the woman. Why now?
Meaning something changed, said Bogart.
The probabilities lie there, yeah, said Decker. Do the Dabneys know about this?
I doubt it, said Bogart.
We'll need to tell them, and confirm they all have alibis.
You think one of the daughters or their mom came over here in the middle of the night and blew out their housekeeper's brains? Said Milligan dubiously.
I know that one of the daughters got her father implicated in an espionage scheme that ended with his murdering someone who was spying on this country and then killing himself. So I would say nothing is out of the realm of possibility with that family.
Milligan didn't look convinced, but he didn't look so dubious anymore either. Bogart said, Todd and I will stay here and learn what we can. Why don't you all head over there now and do the interview?
Works for me, said Decker. But you think I can poke my head into her house for just a minute?
He followed Milligan and Bogart back over to a pair of homicide detectives who had just appeared in the doorway of the murdered woman's home. That left Brown and Jameson alone. The latter looked at the former.
About our earlier discussion,
began Jameson. Brown looked at her.
You were right about some things, and wrong about others. I'll let you figure out which is which.
And that's all she would say.
Sissy's dead?
Ellie looked at the three of them sitting across from her in the library as though they were aliens just landed on Earth.
Decker said, She was murdered, shot in the head. Looks to be a professional hit. Do you have any information that could help us on that?
I can barely process what you're telling me,
said Ellie, who looked nearly paralyzed.
I thought she was here. I just assumed she had come to work like she always did.
Jules, Amanda, and Samantha were standing beside their mother, still clad in their robes. All of the daughters looked visibly upset. Samantha was quietly crying. Amanda was leaning her head against Jules' shoulder. Only Jules seemed in control of herself. She stared resolutely at Decker.
Are we in danger?
She said.
Decker looked at her. It's possible. We can have an agent posted outside the house.
Let me ask you another question,
said Jules.
Where is Natalie?
She's in France,
said her mother.
She left yesterday.
Jules kept her gaze on Decker.
She's not in France. Corbett texted me last night. She never got on the plane. She called him and said there was a change of plan.
What change of plan?
Exclaimed Ellie.
What is going on? Where is your sister?
Jules said,
That's what I'm asking them, because Natalie also told Corbett that she had run into some legal trouble when leaving the country.
Brown spoke up.
I'm with DIA, Defense Intelligence. We were investigating your husband for possible espionage, which turned out to be the case.
But he was helping out Natalie's stupid husband,
said Jules.
No, unknown to your father, he was helping out Natalie. She had the gambling problem, not Corbett. She got your dad involved to solve her debt problem.
That's crap,
snapped Jules.
What proof do you have?
We have definitive video proof, plus your sister's confession. She's already done a deal in exchange for leniency.
Ellie nearly collapsed off her chair. Jules caught her and shouted,
What the hell do you think you're doing telling her stuff like this with no warning?
I was just answering your question,
replied Brown.
But you need to know that the police will be coming here to interview you about Cecilia Randall's death. They'll want to know if you know anything about it.
What could we possibly know?
Demanded Jules.
They'll also want to know if you have alibis for when she was killed.
You can't possibly think that we had anything to do with Sissy's death,
said Ellie.
She was part of our family. She helped raise the girls, for God's sake.
The police will still ask for alibis, said Decker. It's standard procedure.
When was she killed?
Asked Jules. Early this morning, say around 2 or so.
Well, we were all here asleep,
said Jules.
And each of you can verify that the others were here?
Said Brown. Ellie said,
I went to bed around 11. I heard Jules and Samantha come upstairs around midnight. I was reading and heard them talking.
And I opened the door and said goodnight to Mom,
said Jules.
And I did too,
said Samantha.
And Jules and I are sharing a room. We have our own bedrooms, but
I didn't want to be alone. I went to bed around 1, but I went back downstairs for my glasses and I checked on Mom. She was sound asleep, and so was Jules when I got back to the room.
Okay, that accounts for you three,
said Brown, turning to Amanda.
And you?
Amanda abruptly sat down.
I went up to bed before anyone else. I wasn't feeling well. I went to sleep and just woke up about an hour ago.
So you didn't talk to or see anyone else?
Brown looked at the others.
Did any of you check on your sister last night?
Oh, come on,
barked Jules.
Look at her. She's only got one arm. Do you really think she's capable of shooting a gun? And she's seen Sissy, what, maybe a handful of times over the last 10 years? Why in the hell would she kill her? Why would any of us, for that matter?
We're not saying that you did. We're actually doing you a favor because when the police come and ask, you'll have ready answers.
Jules seemed taken aback by this and sat next to Amanda and put an arm protectively around her. Ellie said,
Where is Natalie?
She's with the FBI right now.
Is she going to prison?
I have no way of knowing those details,
said Brown.
I can tell you that the possible charges against her are very serious. I would not be surprised if she didn't spend some time in prison.
Oh, my God,
gushed Samantha. Amanda burst into tears.
What the hell is going on? Our whole family is disintegrating right in front of us.
Jules stared over at Brown.
We didn't kill Sissy. We didn't know anything about what Nat may or may not have done. I still don't understand why Daddy killed himself.
She pulled away from Amanda and put her head in her hands. In a trembling voice, Ellie said,
Would you mind if we were just left alone for a while? We just need to be together as a family for just a little while.
Decker, Brown, and Jameson stood. Decker said, We're going to figure this out, Mrs. Dabney, one way or another.
But that won't bring back Walt or Sissy or change what will happen to Natalie.
No, ma'am, it won't. They filed out, leaving the crushed Dabney family in the library. Outside, Brown turned to Decker.
What do you think?
I think something is off, but I don't know what it is. Chapter 58.
You want to explain what you meant?
Decker had climbed out of Brown's car and headed into the WFO. Jameson had stayed seated. When Decker looked back at her, she waved him on. He glanced at Brown and then walked to the entrance and disappeared inside. Brown eyed Jameson in the rear view.
I thought I was pretty clear.
Clear as mud, right and wrong. You didn't say what about.
You want to do this now?
We can keep putting it off and the resentment will continue to build and maybe we get to a point where nothing the other says will matter.
Brown put the car in park, undid her seatbelt, and turned to look at Jameson.
You were right that I screwed up. But you were wrong that I don't care. I care what Decker thinks about me, and I care about Melvin, even though I haven't known him very long. I got a good vibe from him right away. We talked. A lot.
He thinks the world of you and Decker. I would never hurt Melvin, and I know he would never hurt me. He's not that kind of a guy. Believe me, I know the kind that would. I've dated them.
I have too,
conceded Jameson.
Look, I was pretty rough on you, and that wasn't fair.
I'm used to things not being fair. My father was a good guy and a great soldier. He did wonderful things at DIA. But he wanted a son, not a daughter. But I was all he had. He didn't discourage me from joining the ranks, but it wasn't like he encouraged me either. Maybe he didn't care one way or another, but it still felt like someone had stuck a shiv between my ribs when I told him I'd joined DIA, and all he could say was, Are you sure you want to do that? Because isn't it time you settle down and start a family? I'd busted my ass to serve at the same agency he had, and that's all he could say. I bet that hurt like hell.
Brown shrugged.
Things are better gender-wise, sure, but they're far from perfect. Most guys I meet, when they find out what I do, they're either scared off or they try to prove they're more of a badass than I am. So that means I don't have many second dates, and at work, it's mostly guys wondering why I'm there taking a slot that a man should have. Same with me,
said Jameson.
I'm surrounded by guys all day, and then there's Decker. He's a guy. But he's not really a guy. He's, well, he's Decker.
Brown smiled and then laughed.
Somehow I know exactly what you mean. And Melvin is different, too. He's special, Alex. He wasn't intimidated by me at all. He's secure enough in his own skin to not be jealous of what I do. I agree with you that Melvin is very special, and he deserves someone special. And maybe that someone is you.
Brown looked taken aback by this, but said,
Thanks. That means a lot. Are we good?
Asked Jameson.
I think we're as good as we're ever going to be.
She paused.
I heard what happened, that you saved Decker's life.
Jameson glanced down at her waist, where she carried her gun. Brown said,
It's not easy, Alex, and it never gets any easier. It's changed me, Harper. I'm never going to be the same. I killed someone. You didn't change, just a little part of you did. There's a big difference.
But you could move forward at some point?
You will move forward, Alex. I'm not saying it'll be easy because it won't, but it will happen.
Jameson gave her an appreciative smile, climbed out of the car, and walked into the WFO. Decker was waiting for her just inside the doors. He scrutinized her face. No bruises. Good. Any wounds I can't see?
We actually got along very well. I have a whole different opinion of Agent Brown now.
Well, that's good to know.
And you came up again.
How so?
We were just appreciating the fact that you were sort of one of the girls.
Decker eyed her quizzically for a moment. I think I'm just going to let that one pass. They cleared security and rode the elevator up to their floor. Decker had phoned ahead, and Bogart met them as they were walking down the hall. Got something, he said. He led them into a room off the main hall. Milligan was already there, seated at a computer. Bogart turned off the lights and nodded to Milligan, who hit some keys, and a screen affixed to the far wall came to life.
Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, said Bogart. We found some things I don't think J.K. Rowling intended to be in there.
The three sat down, and Bogart said,
Dial it up, Todd.
Milligan hit some more keys, and a page from the book showed up on the screen.
I don't see anything,
said Jameson.
Wait a minute.
Milligan hit some more keys, and suddenly various letters on the page started to shimmer.
They're fluorescing,
exclaimed Jameson.
Yes. We had to try a lot of different interactive light sources, but we found one that worked.
But they're different colors,
said Jameson.
The letters are different colors.
We think we figured that out. If they used this book over a long term, they would have to send separate messages. The different colors are a way for the receiver to know that. The blue you see is one message, the red another. We don't know which is more recent, but we think that's how it works.
But what does it say? Asked Decker.
It's not that simple. The letters don't add up to anything that makes sense. Our code breakers are looking at it, and we've asked for assistance from both NSA and DIA. It might take a while, but at least we know they were passing coded messages this way.
Between Berkshire and Jenkins, said Decker.
Right. She obtained the secrets and coded them here, and then he used a special light to reveal the letters, copied them down, and decoded it. Then he would send it up the line to whoever he's working for.
Pretty clever to use a hospice that way, said Decker.
You mean pretty cruel,
added Jameson.
Bogart said, This way, Jenkins and Berkshire would never even have to come into contact. They just used the book.
You think they used this method to communicate the secrets that Dabney stole?
Asked Jameson.
I don't know for certain, but it's a pretty safe bet they did.
And yet Dabney murdered Berkshire. Why?
We do keep coming back to that, agreed Bogart. Remorse for what he'd done?
But we can't show that Dabney and Berkshire actually even met, said Decker.
Well, they could have met at a secret location. Maybe the old house in the woods.
Decker said, So he sells her the secrets. The amount he thinks is $10 million, but it's actually a lot less than that. He doesn't even see the money transferred. He knows it went, though, because his daughter and her family are still alive. Then he gets remorse, like you said, and kills Berkshire, and then himself. But why out in the open like that? And why would Berkshire have agreed to meet with him near the Hoover Building? That was probably the last place she would want to go. I mean, wouldn't she have maybe smelled a setup?
Maybe not, rejoined Bogart. I mean, he'd just done a deal with the woman. She might have thought he wanted to do another.
A spy who uses a subterfuge, like a book at a hospice, so she doesn't even have to meet another spy she's been working with for a long time, decides to do a face-to-face with a guy she's maybe done one act of espionage with near the headquarters of the American agency tasked with catching spies? He looked at Bogart. Really, how much sense does that make?
Not much, conceded Bogart. But it happened.
No, maybe it didn't, replied Decker.
Chapter 59.
Sissy's dead?
Decker stared across at Natalie. She had been formally charged, had lawyered up, and was being held because she was considered a flight risk. Because of the sensitive nature of the case, the sole court proceeding conducted so far had been done in the judge's chambers. The woman looked like she had aged 10 years since they had stopped her from flying out of Dulles. Decker nodded. He had asked to meet with Natalie alone. The others were waiting in another room.
She was executed, actually.
Why would anyone do that to her? She was our housekeeper.
Since you were little?
Yes, Sissy had worked for my parents since as long as I can remember.
Well, someone did kill her.
But why do you think it's connected to our family?
I don't know for certain that it is, but I have to check out the possibility. It is a little coincidental, you have to admit.
Natalie nodded.
I guess it is. Do my mom and sisters know?
Yes, they all took it hard.
Mom raised us, but Sissy was always there for us, and Mom loved her. Dad was gone a lot, and I'm not sure what Mom would have done without Sissy.
I'm sure. You were lucky to have her.
So why did you want to see me?
Have you gotten your deal yet?
I think they're still working on it.
Her lips trembled.
My lawyer thinks I'll have to do some time in prison.
She looked up at Decker.
I won't be able to see my daughter if I'm in prison, right?
Have you talked to your husband? She nodded and used a handkerchief to blow her nose.
He said he's flying over with Tasha.
She rubbed her eyes.
That was all bullshit about him. Corbett's actually a really good guy. All this crap I'm in, it was my fault. I got addicted to gambling and I couldn't stop. He tried to help me, but I was sick, I guess.
Admitting that is a big first step to getting better.
Yeah,
she said despondently.
I guess my family knows about me.
We told them some. They're very worried about you.
Can I see them at some point?
I don't see why not.
I've really messed up my life, haven't I?
You're not the first, and you won't be the last. He hunched forward. But you can help yourself by helping us. She shot him a glance.
But I've told you everything I know.
You actually might know some things you don't even know that you know.
I don't understand. Like what?
When the money was sent to pay off your true gambling debts, did you call your dad and let him know?
Of course I did.
He thought it was $10 million, though, right? She nodded.
That's what I told him because that's what they told me to say.
And they did that because they wanted your dad's only recourse to be selling classified information. That would be the only way he could raise that kind of money in the short term.
Agent Decker, what if he had just refused to help me? Then what would have happened?
They might have had a plan B to get to your dad.
And the gambling debts?
That would have been bad for you. But they apparently read your dad right. They knew he wouldn't refuse you.
That makes me feel even shittier. I killed my father, and the only thing he ever did for me was pretty much everything.
She put her head down on the table and quietly sobbed. Natalie, when you called your dad about the money being paid and your being safe, what did he say? She slowly lifted her head.
He said he was so relieved, but that he wanted me to get some help. He said if it came to it, he would fly over and bring me home to make sure I got the right help.
But he never made any mention of how he'd come by the money?
No.
But did you suspect? She said slowly.
I didn't know their net worth. But I didn't think they had that sort of cash lying around. Maybe mortgage the house?
Maybe sell secrets?
I won't lie to you. I can't say that it didn't cross my mind. But even though it wasn't $10 million, the people I owed the money to were going to kill me. That I know for a fact.
I don't doubt it. I know people who'd slit your throat for an OxyContin pill. Did he say anything else? Other than what he said about thinking you know somebody but really don't? She sat back in her chair and wiped her eyes with her sleeves.
I didn't tell you everything. The last time I talked to him was 2 days before he shot that woman.
Decker leaned forward. Why didn't you tell us before?
I was in shock. I guess I couldn't believe what I'd done to my father. I was terrified everything would come out. And of course it did.
Did he call you?
Yes.
What did he say?
He sounded so sad, so hopeless, when he was the biggest optimist I'd ever known. I just figured it was the cancer. He knew he wasn't going to be able to beat it. That would depress anyone, right?
Right. What else? Prompted Decker.
He said that whatever happened, I should remember our family as it was. The happy times. When we were all young. Before all the crap in life just took over.
What did you say to that?
I tried to cheer him up. I told him I would come and visit him soon. But it was like he wasn't listening to me. He said that when you're looking at the end of your life coming, it was the most clarifying moment he'd ever had.
Clarifying moment? I wonder what he meant by that.
I don't know. I tried asking him, but he just wasn't listening. I thought he was starting maybe to lose it.
What else? Natalie choked back a sob.
It was so stupid. He asked me if I remembered when I was a little girl, and we had all gone to Disney World. And I went on one of the rides, and I had a really bad asthma attack. I mean, really bad. They had to take me to a hospital in an ambulance. Mom was unhinged by it, so she stayed with my sisters while Dad rode in the back with me. He was very comforting because I was so scared. My dad was always so strong, so calm, no matter what.
What did he say to you about that time?
I told him I remembered it really well. I had nightmares about it for a year after. I literally thought I was going to die because I couldn't catch my breath. I had no idea why he was bringing that up now. So when I asked him, he said, "Remember, when the going got tough, who was there for you? Remember, your old man was right there holding your hand. Always think of me trying to do the right thing, honey. Always. No matter what."
Why do you think he said that?
He was dying. I didn't read any more into it other than that. I didn't know he was going to shoot someone 2 days later and then kill himself. I just thought he wanted me to remember him in a good way. He didn't have to tell me that. I would have done that regardless. I loved my dad.
But now that you know what he did, does it change how you interpret his words on that call? Natalie looked at him curiously through bloodshot eyes.
I hadn't really thought about it that way, I guess. Do you think it changes things?
I think it might change everything, replied Decker. Chapter 60. Decker sat on the bleachers. Melvin Mars was right next to him. They were at a local D.C. high school football field, watching the varsity team practice. "Growing the kids bigger every year," said Mars. "They look like a college team." Decker nodded. The sky was overcast and a very fine drizzle had started. "They're running a pro set," said Decker. "Everybody wants to get to the NFL these days." "I think a lot of these kids would be okay with just getting a shot at a college education," said Mars. "You might be right about that." "So you called me up to watch a high school football team practice?" "I talked to Harper Brown," said Decker. "Oh, right. Yeah. I went over to your hotel to check on you really early the other morning when you didn't answer your phone."
"And you saw her leaving?"
"Yeah. She told me. She also told me about Alex shooting that guy."
"Damn. How's she doing?"
"She'll be okay." He paused. "So, you and Harper Brown?"
"What do you want me to say? It just happened."
"You don't owe me an explanation, Melvin. You're an adult. You can do what you want."
"It's been a long time for me, Decker."
"You going to see her again?"
"Yeah, I plan to."
"Good for you."
"You mean that?"
"Why go through life alone?"
"Hey, hold on. I'm not popping the question or anything. We're just hanging out, having some fun."
"Nothing wrong with that."
"What about you?"
"What about me what?"
"You just said it. Why go through life alone?" I'm not alone. I've got you, Alex, Bogart, Milligan. You know what I mean. Hey, didn't you know Alex and I are like an old married couple? We argue a lot. About you. When Mars looked at him quizzically, Decker said, long story. Short answer is, we're both happy for you. Thanks. Both men watched the players for a few minutes. Mars said, their wideout is one fast dude with moves and good hands. You see the post-route stutter he just did before taking it downtown? Reminded me of you. But then you could always just run over someone, too, if the moves didn't work. Yeah, well, that's ancient history. You been thinking about what you want to do? Sure. No answers yet. Just taking it one day at a time. How's your case coming? It's taken a couple of twists, actually. Things starting to gel for you yet? Just when they start to, something else comes along and screws it up. Mars patted Decker on the shoulder. My money's still on you, bro. Decker said, you want to go see someone who likes football? Sure. Who? You'll see. An hour later, they pulled into the parking lot of Dominion Hospice. Hospice? Said Mars as they climbed out of the car. Come on, Melvin. Minutes later, they were sitting in Joey Scott's room. Mars stared down at the boy in obvious distress, but Decker said to Joey, this is my friend Melvin Mars. He was an All-American running back at Texas and was a Heisman Trophy finalist a while back. He never got to play in the NFL, but he would have been a Hall of Famer. He pointed to the picture on Joey's nightstand, like your buddy Peyton there.
Wow,
said Joey. He held up his hand for Mars to shake.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Mars.
Mars's hand swallowed the boy's as he gently shook it. Just call me Melvin, he said, glancing at Decker. Decker said, Joey played football too. Would have been a heck of a player. Yep, I can see that, said Mars. I bet you were fast, Joey. You got that build. Joey nodded.
I was really fast.
He coughed and tried to sit up. Mars bent down to help him.
And I could throw, too. I played quarterback in Pop Warner.
Probably the most important position on the field, said Mars. He pulled up a chair and sat down next to the bed. I remember one game when we were behind the whole way. We were all discouraged, pretty sure we were going to lose. Well, our QB comes into the huddle after a timeout and says, okay, guys, we're going to win this game because we're 11 men with one goal, and nobody can stop that. I've got this, and I've got your back, so let's do this thing. You know what?
What?
Asked Joey breathlessly. We won that game and everyone after that, including the Cotton Bowl. He held up one finger. 'Cause one guy believed in us. That was all it took. Joey smiled as Mars held out his fist for Joey to knuckle smack. Joey looked over at Decker.
Thanks for bringing Melvin to see me. He's cool.
Yeah, I think so too, said Decker. After they left Joey and were walking back to the car, Mars asked quietly, so he's got no shot? Apparently not, said Decker. Shit, he ain't even had a chance at a life. I know, said Decker. Life sucks. A lot. Mars looked over at Decker. I guess we both know that. You made his day, Melvin. He did the same for me. How so? Just makes you think about the future, what I'm going to do. Joey doesn't have that chance, so it makes me not want to screw up with mine. I mean, you only get one shot, right? Decker slowly nodded. They climbed into the car and Mars drove off. Back to your apartment? He asked. Yeah, Alex is there. You got dinner plans? Yeah, actually I do. Brown? Harper. Decker cracked a smile. Harper. Maybe we could do a double date down the road. That requires two couples, and Alex and I are not a couple. I'm more like her big brother. Her really big brother. I know that. It would just be hanging out. Mars dropped Decker at the apartment and drove away. Decker watched him go for a bit. He saw Jameson's car in the parking lot, so he knew she was there. But he didn't go in.
Instead, he turned to the east and started walking. 20 minutes later, he was standing outside of Cecilia Randall's row house. The police and FBI were finishing processing the scene. Decker's creds got him inside. He stood in the small front room and looked around. An FBI tech closed up her evidence kit and looked over at him.
You were here before with Special Agent Bogart.
That's right. What can you tell me?
One shot to the back of the head, instant death. She was found in her bedroom.
On the bed?
Nope, next to it.
Did she fall off?
No, all forensics point to her being on her knees next to the bed.
Whoever killed her probably made her do that?
That's my thinking. She was in a long shirt and pajama bottoms. The bed had been slept in.
And I understand no forced entry. All locks work? Windows?
All secured. This is not the safest neighborhood, and while she didn't have a security system, she had extra locks on the front and back doors. All the windows had security pins.
If she was asleep, then someone either picked the locks or had a key.
We checked the door locks. Even the best pick guns will leave some marks behind. We found none.
So a key, then?
Looks to be.
Anything stolen?
She had lots of knickknacks, but there was no jewelry to speak of, no prescription drugs in her medicine cabinet. Her purse was found, and her wallet, credit cards, and cash were still in it.
So no robbery, then? They just came to kill her?
I understand this might be connected to a case you're working on.
It could be very connected.
Well, good luck. Hope you find who did this.
Me too, thought Decker. Chapter 61.
We can't find him. It's like he vanished off the face of the earth.
Bogart looked immensely frustrated as they sat in his office at the WFO. Decker, Jameson, and Milligan sat across from him. The FBI special agent's hair was mussed, his tie was crooked, and he had a couple days' worth of beard stubble. These were distinct cracks in the man's normally spit-polished appearance.
Alvin Jenkins had maybe at most a half-hour head start,
said Jameson.
We weren't with Joey all that long before Decker figured it out with the book. How could he have disappeared so fast?
He must have booked it right after he left you, said Milligan. We found his car in the parking lot, which means he had assistance. He didn't hoof it on foot. This looks like a well-executed plan already in place. He probably made a call and help arrived.
Bogart added, We searched his apartment. It was nearby in Herndon. If you think Berkshire's place was bare bones, you should have seen Jenkins's digs. There was nothing in the fridge, one set of clothes in the closet, some underwear and toiletries. The furniture was all rented and came with the place. We still tore the place apart and took his toothbrush and other relevant material to run through our databases to try to get a match. Nothing's come back so far. Like Berkshire, I doubt he's on any database.
But he got to work at the hospice,
pointed out Jameson.
They had to do some background checking there.
Not as much as you might think, replied Milligan. The pay's not great, and they have a hard time finding employees. I think they let things slide on the checking out phase. But like Berkshire, it could have all been falsified anyway. I can tell you that nothing has come back on this guy yet. Jameson looked at Bogart.
So we've got nothing, then?
What we have is a mess, said Bogart.
Decker answered, We have far more than nothing, even if it is messy right now. If we can just piece it all together. He eyed Bogart. Someone had a key to Cecilia Randall's home. No forced entry. She was asleep when the killer struck. She didn't let anyone in at that hour.
The killer could have gotten a key any number of ways.
Possibly, and we'll need to check them all out. You spoke with Natalie, said Milligan. And she told you the story about the ambulance ride her father recently brought up before everything happened. What do you think that meant? He was trying to tell her something. He couldn't do so directly without implicating her.
Implicating her?
Said Jameson.
How so?
He stole secrets to pay her gambling debts, or which he thought were his son-in-law's gambling debts. I doubt he told her how he was acquiring the money, but he knew it was paid because she was alive. And she told him everything was good on that. But in the course of getting the money to pay off that debt, Dabney ran into Berkshire, somehow, some way. I think, in fact, that Berkshire was in this from the beginning. I think she knew about the debts. Hell, maybe she and her cohorts encouraged Natalie's addiction and thus got her to run up these massive debts. knowing she'd have to turn to her father for help. Wait a minute. If that's the case, then Berkshire must have been targeting Dabney for a while. Yet we can show no connection between them. Doesn't matter. For argument's sake, let's assume there was a connection. Dabney goes to Berkshire with the secrets. He sets his price. She agrees to it, knowing that it won't cost $10 million to resolve the debt. The secrets are passed, the money goes out. Some of it goes to pay off the debt. Hell, for all we know, whoever Berkshire was working for might have bought out the debt from the original source, so the payee and the payer might well be the same. So money-wise, it's a wash for them. Jameson said,
So if the transaction was successfully completed between them, why would Dabney murder Berkshire?
Because while she had the upper hand on him vis-a-vis the truth about the gambling debts, he knew something that she didn't. He paused. He knew he was dying. Bogart said,
So he killed her because he knew he would never be tried for the crime? He intended to kill himself instead of letting the cancer kill him?
Yes and no. Jesus, Decker, this is getting more complicated than an algorithm, exclaimed Milligan. I think it's actually quite linear. Yes, that he wanted vengeance because she was a spy that he had sold secrets to and he couldn't live with that. He couldn't get the secrets back, but he could stop her from ever spying on this country again.
Bogart interjected. Okay, that's the yes part. What's the no part?
The no part is how he did it. He lured her somehow to the FBI building and shot her on the spot.
Why did he do that?
He wanted to send a message to someone, a clear message that enough was enough. He wasn't going to do this anymore, and they had better back off.
Bogart sat up straight. Wait, you're saying they were going to make him spy for them again?
Of course. Once they had him do it the first time, they had him for good. If he didn't cooperate, they would release incriminating information and evidence that would bury him. Berkshire would be long gone by then, so she wouldn't suffer. But Dabney would, and his family.
Bogart nodded. So he decided to take the bull by the horns and cut off this possibility. Berkshire dead, and him dead. And this was made possible because they didn't know he was already dying?
Yes.
I'd love to know the answer to two questions right now.
What's that? Asked Bogart.
What was Dabney trying to communicate to his daughter with the ambulance story, and why didn't he just tell her straight out? And the second question? Who was the damn clown?
Chapter 62.
You look miserable,
said Jameson. She was driving and looking over at Decker, who was scrunched in the passenger seat. I'm not miserable, just in pain. I'm going to help you buy a new car, Alex. I can't take too much more of this. I think I'm getting blood clots in my legs.
Remember when you used to take the seat out and just sit in the back?
Not really practical, since it takes 4 tools and an hour to do that.
What kind of car?
She said animatedly. I don't care, so long as it's at least twice the size of this one, with decent legroom. The rain was pestering them again, snarling traffic and making gloomy thoughts seem even gloomier. Decker closed his eyes.
So you said Melvin got to meet Joey Scott?
Decker opened his eyes and nodded. When I told him that Melvin nearly won the Heisman and would have been in the Hall of Fame, I thought Joey was going to burst with excitement.
I'm sure. That makes it even more awful that Berkshire would have used Joey like that. I mean, it would be heartless with any terminally ill patient, but Joey was the only kid in the whole place. And she sat and read to him just so she could use that book to communicate stolen classified information.
Decker's response to this was extraordinary. Alex, turn the car around. We're heading to Virginia.
Virginia? Where?
The hospice. Sally Palmer was still in her office. She explained that with the disappearance of Alvin Jenkins, she was having to work longer hours until he could be replaced.
I can't imagine why he ran off like that, and the police won't tell me anything,
she said crossly as she sat across from them in her office.
I suppose you can't either,
she added.
You would suppose right, said Decker. Alvin Jenkins, when did he start working here?
Alvin?